Welcome to the Social Podcast, where no discussion or debate is off limits.
It's hump day. Welcome to the Social. Glad to have you with us. Host of Mighty Trains, Teddy Wilson, is also joining us today. Welcome back to the show, Teddy.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Well, it's great to see you, Teddy. And we are starting with Ryan Reynolds, who announced on Instagram that he's taking a little sabbatical from movie making after wrapping his latest film, Spirited. So what do we think about the idea of sabbaticals? Teddy, let's start with you.
Well, I mean, Ryan Reynolds can do whatever he wants as long as he continues to play Deadpool. As long as he comes back to the character of Deadpool, he can go off and do whatever he wants. I think the fact that this is even a story is kind of indicative of how interested we are in Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively and how much we love them. Because, I mean, the latest rumors are that Deadpool, the next film, is going to start filming at the end of next year. So he's really just taken like a year to be a parent. He's got three daughters, as you know. So to me, it's like, yeah, do whatever you want. I think taking a sabbatical, the sting is probably taken out of it a little bit if you're millionaires like they are. But I really love them as a couple. I love how they troll each other online. She had a really funny response to him announcing this as well, saying that Michael Caine just did it, you know. And I really love following their little barbs back and forth. So yeah, go do whatever you want, Ryan Reynolds. And he's a smart, interesting guy. I think he owns like a football club. He's got a booze company. He just bought an ownership stake in a telecom or a cell phone company. So not every actor I would be fascinated to see what they do at this time, but I really am, because he's clearly a smart, capable person. So yeah, have fun, Ryan Reynolds, but just come back to Deadpool.
You know, is he at all, does anybody think that maybe he's making us miss him on purpose a little bit? I think celebrities might be a little guilty of being overexposed perhaps from time to time. Is this a way to build it? Because like Teddy, you said, he's going to be all right. He's clearly like not stopping working. He's got a lot of stuff on the go. But is this going to make us miss him a little bit so that when Deadpool does come back, he is manufacturing us missing him?
I think that this is an exaggeration.
I miss Ryan Reynolds every day.
You miss him every day.
I miss him every day. I wish there was a news story about he and Blake Lively every single day, because they just make me happy. So I definitely will miss him, but it's happening already.
I'm not sure that this is, I think that him taking a sabbatical is a sabbatical from acting, meaning he may not be on a set with a script playing a different character. But as Teddy mentioned, he has so much going on, including the football club. He owns a professional football club in the UK. And they're actually filming a Ted Lasso-style reality show about his ownership of the football club. So we will see Ryan Reynolds. He's active on Twitter. He's active on Instagram. You know, don't worry. You're going to get your Ryan Reynolds content, everybody.
Well, and this is it's what Melissa said, and he wants us to miss him more. To me, that's kind of selfish, because who doesn't love Ryan Reynolds, and he needs more of our love? Take it easy, Ryan Reynolds.
How quickly you turn, Teddy.
I think it's interesting to think about sabbaticals in general, because like, I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but like, I'd like a sabbatical. Like, imagine, really, the only realm that actually does sabbaticals, I think, is really academia. Like, you know, I have friends who are university professors, and they get every few years, they get a year off paid to do work and research and produce stuff. I mean, this, I feel like way back in the day, a bunch of old dudes like, I don't know, Socrates, Plato, were like, let's establish something right out of the gate so that we can just take some time to ourselves to think. And I mean, who else can afford to do this? But I, for one, would love this. And I wonder if there are certain companies who could think about this, maybe not giving a year off, because that's probably not affordable to pay for employees to do this, but even smaller mini sabbaticals to be like, hey, what are you interested in? Where are you not feeling like you're getting massaged? Not literally, but figuratively. And how can we facilitate maybe some time off to go away and, you know, do some creative ventures and produce them? I think you would come back with a better employee.
Well, you know, you got me thinking, Sin, because I was saying that there were a lot of people who were, I'm going to call it a forced sabbatical over this pandemic, because a lot of people who were laid off and didn't want to be, and maybe they were collecting some kind of assistance from the government, and they were literally sitting there at home thinking about their entire lives, like literally. And we've actually seen, to your point, Cynthia, the repercussions of that. The consequence is now a lot of people deciding not to go back to their old jobs. They've asked the big questions, like, what is life? What is my meaning? What is my purpose? Which I think is what a really good sabbatical should do. It should really open your eyes, make you explore. And I think if an employer, I think they should listen to you, Sin. If an employer wants to attract talent, good talent, and keep them, this might be one of the perks. Hey, a paid month-long sabbatical here and there?
To allow people, and I worked at a company once where they called them stages. I took a stage, and I loved
it. Stage.
But essentially, they let people go and work in different departments. So I think if we could take this a step further and say, what if you could just go work in a completely different job for 3 months, 6 months, up to a year, and have your job to come back to? Because can I just tell you this? Like, I'm a comedian, I'm an actor, this is what I do. But I've always secretly, and maybe not so secretly, wanted to spend multiple months as a truck driver.
Oh,
and
what?
Me
I
too.
Hate, okay, Teddy, you and I are going on the
I swear. Like,
what a difference.
I see
it's
a show.
It's meditative.
I see
you get
a show.
On the road.
Yeah.
Right? A reality show. This would be great. And it's different. It's just like, it's a, now my, that job would be like, you take, you know, this load from point A to point B and your job is done. You feel good. You've accomplished something. There's no auditions. There's no late nights. And there's no going on stage.
Can I just
like,
say, I'm sorry.
What a joy.
Our team members are already in our earpieces saying, oh, please let us produce this show. We're on to something.
I'm in.
I call shenanigans on both you because you guys both like an audience, clearly. And the one thing you're not going to get in a truck is any audience. No audience
there. Those truck stops are happening, Sin. I don't know.
Yes.
I just said it on the CB.
What exactly is happening at the truck stop? There's a lot happening at truck stops. That's a show too.
Well, and if you ever want a sabbatical, work on an international travel show during a global pandemic, then you'll get a forced sabbatical.
Oh my gosh. Okay. We're going to move along to this next story, which is that Jamie Lee Curtis, I mean, she is the OG scream queen, but she told Entertainment Weekly that she hates being scared by scary movies. So what are your thoughts about horror movies, Aisha?
I love horror movies. And here's why, okay? I think a lot of people are like, they're in or they're out. But I love them because I love controlled terror, okay? I'm creating, it's an hour and a half where my adrenaline is pumping. Yes, I'm sweating. Yes, I'm covering my eyes. Yes, I'm screaming at the screen in the movie theater, embarrassing everybody I'm with. But then it's over. And I can go home and my life seems more calm and joyful and happy. And I think that there's something, it makes me feel grateful for all of the safety I have in my life. When I can go in, I see some zombies for an hour and a half. Some people die. I'm sorry about it. But then some people survive and I'm a survivor. I leave the theater, you know, with the, my face is greasy with popcorn and grease from all over my hands. But
yeah,
I love them. I love them. I know that you guys, and not everyone loves them. I know, Lainey, you don't love them. I see that. I see that, Mel.
Not for me. I feel like real life is scary enough. That's why. The news is scary enough for me. I don't need to throw myself deeper into the deep end. I'm good. I'm over here.
But, you know, it is interesting because part of what I love about horror is, like Aisha was saying, it's a way to kind of, you know, have your amygdala fire, feel that fear response, but in a safe environment. And I think when we feel that fear response, whether it's sitting in a movie, in a theater watching a horror movie or taking a roller coaster, I think it kind of harkens back to our like primordial lizard brains where we were maybe being pursued by wild predators, you know, by animals, and where that was part of our day-to-day life. I think feeling scared is something that, you know, other than the scary things in day-to-day life, but in terms of feeling under threat is not something that we feel very often. So I think we're tapping into that when we sit in a movie theater. And it's fascinating to me that though Jamie Lee Curtis hates being scared, she's made a career out of it. It's like it's like hating apple pie and then starting an apple pie company, you know?
I thought it really interesting that the way that you, Teddy, and Aisha are talking about the scary movie experience is that it ends like the moment the movie is over, because that is not my experience.
Truth.
Like, it's one thing to have it isolated in that two hours in the movie theater, but for me, then I'm scared, I take it home, or in my case, like, the last time I watched a scary movie, it was in 2013, it was a movie called The Conjuring, and it was for a press junket. So I was staying in a hotel, because the media was staying there. I had to go back to the hotel. Some hotels are haunted. So it was like a scary night. I heard the wind in the night. And then I kept thinking about that stupid, horrible doll and exorcisms and whatever. And I couldn't sleep.
No.
Like, how do you leave it in the theater?
I mean,
how do you leave it in the theater?
You've been on set and you know the way that films are made. So you have to keep coming back to the fact that it's not real. And this is the magic of
the
movies.
The Conjuring was based on a real story. All these like hauntings of this were based on real stories.
And Freddy Krueger can get you in your dreams just because you fall asleep.
Yeah, you're not.
Oh, oh my gosh, you brought him up?
Yeah.
Just before we go to break, he's actually oh my gosh, that was my childhood fear.
You don't leave
it. It's not better.
Wow. Thanks a lot,
you guys.
Thanks a lot, Teddy. Just kidding. Love you.
So it has been now well over a week, and Iqaluit residents still cannot drink their tap water. So city staff found evidence of fuel contamination in the water supply. They are now scrambling to flush it out. So we're going to start first with reaction to the story that really the entire country is talking about. Aisha, what do you think about this story and so many new elements that are coming out about it?
I mean, this is an ongoing issue with a lot of our northern communities and a lot of communities around Canada. And I think, you know, people are talking about how there's cracks in these water tanks because of climate change and things are shifting. But also we have to remember that there's systematic racism that also means people are not giving enough resources, giving enough time. There's not enough airtime for these situations that are happening over and over and over again. This is an emergency situation, but this has been an ongoing issue with all, you know, with infrastructure, with fire safety, with hygiene, with health, and with water in these communities. So there's things we need to do long-term, but in the immediate, these people need help. We need to be giving resources. We need to be sending supplies. And there is an Iqaluit resident named Andrea Anderson who started a GoFundMe to, you know, there's water being sent up there, but she's saying some people don't even have jugs to put the water in, so they can't keep it. So she started a GoFundMe so she could get people the jugs. She could get shower bags for pregnant women. She could get already prepared formula so they didn't have to use water and that babies could still be nourished. But I think we need to do both things, the emergency sending supplies and helping this crisis, but also not forgetting that this is a long-term problem that needs to be addressed by everyone at the federal level and the individual level moving forward.
Yeah, you're right. At the federal level, it was a campaign promise in 2016 by the Trudeau Liberals that by 2021, the clean water issue would be taken care of. That was not a campaign promise that the federal Liberals delivered. And they actually said, you know, about last year or so, they would not be able to meet that timeline. For various reasons, one of them is the pandemic-ish, but they were behind the timeline even before COVID hit in North America before lockdown in March 2020. So this is something that, as Aisha, you said, people have long known about, so it clearly has been put on the back burner. Canada has been called out by international organizations specifically for this thing, from Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, and it goes hand in hand with genocide. That is the word, right? Genocide. We talk about residential schools. We talk about this country's treatment of Indigenous people. We talk about that word genocide. And it's not just residential schools. It's not just the lack of care for missing and murdered women and girls. It's also when we don't care about the clean water in these communities, it leads to generational trauma. Because, you know, Aisha, you were talking about pregnant women without clean water. Children in these communities are growing up in these conditions. What do you think happens? It means that as they grow up, there's depression, economic, financial, emotional, all of that.
Health issues.
It goes on. And that's why we call it genocide. Because this country, in ignoring these issues on all these kinds of levels, are subjecting an entire people to a lack of circumstance and opportunity that is eroding their culture and their existence.
And you're absolutely right. The question I have to follow that, though, is how much has the rest of Canada spoken up about this to, for example, their local MP. You see, they care about what their constituents care about. So to turn this a little bit, we can't always just say, it's, you know, of course it's the federal government's issue. Of course it is. And this is also generational. But at what point is it also on us to say very loudly and clearly to our MPs that we voted in, this is a priority for us. I am a citizen. I voted you into office. This is important to me. So I think we do have to take responsibility, because I think the whole country, we should be up in arms because they don't have clean drinking water. What country is this? What country is this? And it's enraging. And I've written to my MP, just to be clear. There's really easy ways for you to just, who is my MP? And write to them and scream that this is a priority for you, too.
I think that's a really great way to put it, I think, Mel, because obviously there's been more dialogue and more of a spotlight placed on First Nations issues. And of course, with the boil water advisories still existing, I think as of September, it was in over 50, there were over 50 boil water advisories in 32 communities, and they have lifted over 100, but there's still a huge distance to go. And as Lainey said, obviously the pandemic complicated things, but they were way, way behind before the pandemic. So they still wouldn't have hit their marks. And it's unconscionable in 2021 that we have any communities in this country that don't have clean drinking water. It's a basic human right. But I think Mel's point is great too about putting pressure at the local level on your members of parliament and your local representatives, in addition to having this sort of dialogue about it, in addition to the fact that it's a good thing that there's more of a spotlight placed on it. There's so far to go. And prompting that by placing local pressure on your local representatives, I think, is a really wonderful point.
Yeah, I mean, Teddy, this is one of Canada's capital cities. Like, let's not forget. And one of the most shameful aspects of this story to me was the fact that the citizens were the ones who alerted this situation to the authorities. They were increasingly going on Facebook pages and on social media, and because they'd noticed that the water had this smell and this taste. And I just wonder who was asleep at the wheel, first of all, that the people supposedly in charge didn't notice this. And then when they eventually started testing the water, they said, oh, we've tested it, it's safe to drink, when in fact it was not. They were only testing for certain things. They were testing for higher bacteria levels. They were not testing for hydrocarbons. Until they opened up a tank and actually smelled fuel. Because as you mentioned, Aisha, this is an environmental issue to some degree, the infrastructure, because of environmental and climate change partially, has broken down because of changing water levels. We won't get into all of the science of that. But the fact is that even once they fix, or if they, when they fix these issues, first of all, where's the trust going to be? I mean, would you, if they've been saying, oh, no, it's fine, we didn't even notice it. This is what happened in Flint, Michigan, in fact, is that even though they have fixed their infrastructure and the water is indeed safe to drink, the residents, understandably, don't trust the authorities anymore.
You know what, you're just making a trust, Cynthia? Do the people who make the decisions not actually live in that community?
Well, these are great questions.
That person who was in charge, there was no one in charge. I mean, you mentioned it today.
They have not had a director of their Department of Public Works there in 15 months. And I think that we're seeing the ramifications of that.
Yeah. And then there's the larger issues just going forward about climate change and the way it's going to impact. And it's going to start in these communities. We're already seeing that. So, again, it becomes a larger conversation around, to go back to what you were saying, Mel, is how do we put pressure on our government to make sure that the climate issue does not go by the wayside and as we continue to shed a light on what's happening in Indigenous communities across this country?
Well, those are two things that we can do right away, right? As Aisha said, there's that GoFundMe, so check that out. And then, as what Mel suggested, scream over online in a good way. But it's one time it's okay to scream online, right?
That's right.
Your MP, let them know. All right, to something different now. People on Reddit, speaking of online communities, are sharing the moments they realized they weren't young anymore, like hearing their favorite song referred to as an oldie, or throwing their back out, scooping cat litter. What are our oldie realization moments? Who wants to share first? Hi, Teddy, how about you?
I'll go. I turn 45 next week, so I'm officially middle-aged. And I get a reminder of it every morning. You know, there are more cracks and more pains where there didn't used to be. Just getting out of bed is an adventure. But I got to say, my real first I'm old moment happened about 5 years ago at a concert. And let me just ask you a question. Have you ever sat down at a concert? Because it is heaven. And I'm not talking about going to the orchestra or the symphony. I was at an LCD sound system concert. You'll boo me? No, I was at the big rock concert. I was at a big rock concert and I was sitting down and I thought, this is heaven. And when the people stood up in front of me, I was the old man being like, sit down. But let me tell you, sitting at a rock show is heaven. So that's when I really knew I was
old. Rest those knees, right, Teddy? Rest those knees. You know when I knew I was old? Yeah, I was that lady on the street that called the cops on a loud party.
Oh,
that's when I knew. Mel.
That's when I knew.
Party girl calls the cops on the party.
Oh, yeah, and I didn't quit until that music was turned down, friends. That's when I knew. That's when I knew.
Does anyone know this moment?
Have you done this moment? Boo you and Teddy.
When you're, like, trying to read something? Teddy does this all the time in jest, but I'm doing it for real. Anyway, Aisha, what have you... What's your...
my old moment, see, I think people often think because I'm a comedian and I started, you know, about 10 years ago, they think I'm younger than I am. So they assume I'm about, you know, a decade younger. And someone was asking for my date of birth for something. And I gave them the year and I said 1980. And they went, like I was going to add another number. I'm like, no, 80. I'm an 80s baby from 1980.
Okay, and they were like, oh. That is a humble brag, yeah. Aisha, because clearly the person didn't believe you. Did not believe you. They were like, 1989. All right, Aisha, I see what you did there.
Oh my gosh.
I see what you did there. Well, speaking of age, I think, Teddy, your show, Mighty Train's going on to season 4. That is, of course, on Discovery Canada. As you're rolling into season 4, you know, what is the most, you've seen pretty much every train there. What's the most exciting train so far that you've discovered on your travels?
Well, I mean, this is honestly our best season yet. The footage that you're seeing right now is from our season premiere tomorrow night on Discovery. That is Peru. It's a train called the Tren Turístico. It starts in Lima on the coast, and it goes almost 5,000 meters up above sea level, way up high in the Andes Mountains. That's half the height of Mount Everest. It's the second highest train journey on Earth. So that's easily one of my favorite that we've ever covered. It's our season premiere, and the season gets... It still stays amazing from there. You know, it's truly our strongest season yet. We go to Japan. We go back to New Zealand, Spain, Serbia, and Montenegro. I get to go to Vietnam for the first time and ride a train down the spine of that country from Hanoi all the way down to Ho Chi Minh City. Absolutely life-changing. And I really, really am proud of the season. The huge team who work on the show and put it together did an amazing job. And I can't wait for people to see it. But yeah, right out of the gate, our first episode in Peru is one of the most incredible trains on Earth.
Oh my gosh. Ugh. We're glad it was you, because Lainey and I were like pretending like we were
altitude
passing
sickness.
Out. We were like,
altitude sickness.
Did you say 5
on this train? On this train, they have a nurse on every car because so many passengers get
altitude sickness. What?
And you have to get oxygen.
Oh, now I need to watch.
Wow. You're going
a mile. Yeah.
You're going a mile on a train.
Yep. We need to watch that. Hey, Teddy, thank you so much for joining us. It's been so great to see your face. We want to tell everybody,
catch
season 4 of Mighty Trains premiering tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern on Discovery Canada.
Subscribe to The Social Podcast so you don't miss a fiery debate. Until next time, socialites.